Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is John Blythen. I represent the plaintiffs, Ms. Muha and Ms. Kasky, in this case. The Fair Debt Collection Practices Act prohibits debt collectors, of which Encore, the defendant in this case, is one, from making any false statements or misrepresentations in connection with the collection of a debt. Encore sent both plaintiffs and a class of about 7,000 other people a letter that stated that the original agreement with the creditors had been revoked. This was false. The original... excuse me.
What would you have wanted them to say?
Well, it depends a lot on what the status of the debt actually is. There is no evidence in the record that even the charging privileges had been revoked, although that's what Encore is assuming. Encore was assuming that had happened, and what the district court assumed happened as well. If assuming that the charging privileges are the things that had been revoked or taken away or rescinded, it would. If the letter should say that the charging privileges have been rescinded, or you are not allowed to make further charges on this card, it has to say the truth. It can't say that the agreement is revoked, because certainly the agreement with the original creditor still is in effect, even if it's in default, and that's evidenced further by the statements that were sent after Ms. Muha.
But yes, of course, if the agreement were not still in effect, they wouldn't owe any money, right? So how does this intimidate the buyer and seal his rights, right?
Well, Your Honor, it doesn't have to conceal their rights or anything like that in order to violate the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. The statute very clearly prohibits anything that's a false statement or misrepresentation
So are you just seeking statutory damages?
Yes. No, there are no...
there's no actual harm to the creditor. It's just...
The debtors, Your Honor?
To the debtors, yeah. No harm, right?
Right. There doesn't have to be. The Act allows...
There's nothing to suggest there would be any harm here. If anything, it exaggerates their rights.
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Well, they exaggerate their rights. You might, because the recipient might say, well, my agreement was revoked. Well, great, I don't owe you anything.
They could think that, but then they would be harmed, I suppose, later on, if they didn't make payments based on that understanding. But again, that in the circuit's FDCPA law, that's not really relevant to whether it's a violation of the statute or not.
Why aren't you suggesting that they just say nothing, right? Well, if they just eliminated that sentence, therefore your original agreement with the above-mentioned creditor has been revoked, wouldn't that eliminate all the confusion?
It probably would, Your Honor, but the fact is that they actually did include
it. Yes, I know that. I'm asking you whether that would be sufficient compliance if they just eliminated that sentence.
It probably would. There are any number of FDCPA cases where the debt collectors have been, I guess, busted for saying extra things that they didn't have to say. In addition to the statement itself being facially false, based on the plain meaning of the word revoked, which was in the briefing, both the Black's Law Dictionary version and the Merriam-Webster version, which are substantially the same.
Well, are you resting on that, or do you really need this survey?
Your Honor, we need this survey. It's an alternative argument. The survey we do need anyway because it goes to the damages.
Well, I thought you were just asking for statutory damages.
That's right, but one of the...
Do you need a survey for that?
You don't need the survey. Well, you do need the survey to show how many violations that have happened and how...
Isn't the number of violations the numbers of letters sent out?
Yeah,
the
number of letters
sent...
Yeah, it...
If each letter is violative, that's it. That's the measure.
Right.
Your surveyor didn't get the questions right.
I'm sorry?
The survey questions aren't the right questions, are they?
For damages?
For anything.
Well, I disagree that they aren't the right questions for proving liability. There was a control group, as some of the previous cases have had surveys, have said the surveys need to have a control group that shows the basis of what base level of confusion of the letter in general, of the Fair Debt Collection language in general. That was the first question.
Pursuing Judge Tinder's point, isn't an individual letter with a misleading statement, and isn't that a violation that would entitle a recipient to statutory damages?
Yes, but
why do you need a survey?
The survey goes to the amount of damages.
What do you mean? The statutory damages are determined.
Statutory damages are determined by the court. It's any for each individual. It's anywhere for an individual. It's anywhere between nominal damages and $1,000. On a class, there's a cap.
And 0 to 1,000. And so what determines where you are in the range? How confusing or how many? How confusing it is?
There's a whole list of things they use to determine that, and I don't have that in front of me.
Okay, so to get non-zero statutory damage, you're saying you needed a survey.
Yes.
But the problem with your survey is I don't think you can have a survey where the lawyer rather than the survey expert asks the questions.
So I disagree, Your Honor. The survey expert is there to...
No. The most important thing that... Well, one of the most important things that experts and surveys and polling and so on do is design the questions in a way that they won't be slanted. And, of course, a lawyer doesn't have that expertise or the same incentive. I don't understand why the survey expert doesn't do the questions as well as the design of the, you know, how you reach people and what your sample is and so on.
Your Honor, the survey expert is an expert on survey methodology.
Yes, and an important part of the methodology is asking questions in such a way that you get truthful answers rather than confusing. You're talking about confusion. You don't want to confuse the survey respondents and push them to one answer rather than another by your wording.
What you're asking, Your Honor, is not... It's related to the weight of the evidence. The defendant is certainly able to argue, make those same arguments that they did to the district court to the jury. The defendant's expert admitted that the methodology was fine. If they want to argue about whether the questions were slanted,
I think it's very unprofessional for the lawyer to be designing the questions.
Who else is going to do it?
Survey, this the expert, right? You tell him you tell the survey professional, this is the purpose of this survey, to find out how people respond to this sentence in the Dunning letter. And that's what we want to find out, whether they're confused. And so you formulate questions that will elicit that information. And then the survey expert uses knowledge of consumer psychology and what have you to draft the questions.
If that happened, Your Honor, I believe that there would be just as valid, there would be a valid argument on the defense side that the person determining the questions of the survey has no knowledge in FDCPA specific questions. They have no understanding of this.
The only question you have to do, you don't have to have heard of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act to be told that you want to find out whether this sentence confuses some significant number of people. And so you tell the survey expert, draft questions that will elicit that. You don't have to know anything about law to know whether to ask someone whether this sentence is confusing.
Your Honor, my time is up. I just conclude by saying that I believe, plaintiff believes, that this court feels it's unprofessional or that somebody else should have determined the questions is a matter for the jury. There was a survey.
The jury doesn't determine what the proper domain for expert testimony is.
Technical questions about the method.
There's nothing technical about asking someone, is this a confusing sentence? What does this sentence mean to you? You don't have to be a lawyer to ask that question.
I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Blythen. Mr. Schultz?
May it please the Court, Counselor. I'd like to clarify a couple points that were raised by Your Honors with regards to doing surveys and the standard here. Judge Stantmuller decided in the first instance that looking at the letter as a judge, it was compliant with the law, applying the unsophisticated consumer standard that the Seventh Circuit has talked about. And that's the first seven pages of his opinion. The rest of the opinion goes on to say, even if I didn't think from my review of this that I could sufficiently do this under the precedent of the Seventh Circuit, there's a handful of, I think, five cases that talk about whether the judge should decide this or should make it a question of fact to go further, then I would consider other evidence, and the other evidence in this instance being a survey. So the survey was not necessary in order to establish actual damages. It was really a question of whether or not they could meet their evidentiary burden of proof to show that the unsophisticated consumers were viewing this as a false, misleading, or confusing communication. And so that was the purpose of his further analysis, saying even if I'm not right, that I'm not the one to decide this, although I think he is, that they don't have sufficient evidence. I think it's important, and this case can stand for a number of important points, at least two. And the first one I'd like to talk about is regards to the first part of the analysis, the Judge Stantmuller's analysis of this question of a claim under E for being false and using the unsophisticated consumer standard. And that's what he did. And he did that, and he thought, I'm looking at this letter, and I'm applying what this court has said in the Pettit and the White opinions, what an unsophisticated consumer is. It's a person who's got reasonable intelligence, who's sufficiently capable of reading the letter, understanding it, has some economic background, at least in regards to his finances. That's a paraphrase in the test, but the test is clearly stated in your opinions and in the brief. What they've tried to do, and what we're seeing at the trial level anyhow, and in the trenches, as you're familiar with being from the Southern District of Indiana, that they're trying to kind of get away from the unsophisticated consumer standard and trying to say, well, it's false. And we don't have to apply the unsophisticated consumer standard. We don't have to do surveys. Something's false, and therefore it's a violation. This comes up in this case.
It seems he had to do a survey, so what?
Well, I think just depending on how you analyze it, that I think it's appropriate to consider as an E violation that alleges false, misleading, confusing, something that is going to use the unsophisticated consumer as Judge Stantmuller did here, or as they're trying to argue, no, it's a violation, it's false. When we were here a year ago, Your Honor, in the Every case, the series of settlement letter cases, that same approach was made, and they said, well, false is a little different from misleading and confusing under E, and you said, no, they're not, we treat them the same.
I'm completely lost. I don't know what you're driving at.
What I'm driving at, I think, is that Judge Stantmuller.
We use the unsophisticated consumer standard, right?
Yes. And that's what Judge Stantmuller did, and I believe he did correctly. But I'm saying
your claim is that the statement's not false. It was what was revoked, right?
Right. And then to judge it, you look at an unsophisticated consumer. They're saying, no, you don't look at that standard.
How did you show that it was revoked? What in the record shows that the original agreement was revoked?
Well, the original agreement wasn't in the record, and that was something that the judge asked for could it be found.
That makes it difficult to show that that statement was not false.
Well, I think we looked at the letter, the client's business. The letter stated out first that it's been referred to us to get balance in full now. It's a credit card. And so a person got a credit card. It allowed them to buy.
Why is that sentence in there? What does it add to anything? They owe money. What difference does it make what's been revoked or not revoked?
Well, why is that sentence in there? The revoked sentence in there? It was explained in the testimony by Mr. Rowe that they wanted to make it clear to the person, you can't use this card anymore. It's been revoked.
Why did they say that?
Well, there was other ways it could have been said, true. But is this?
It has nothing to do with debt collection. I don't understand.
I think the way Mr. Rowe explained it was they didn't want any confusion by a person going out and using the card.
Well, why don't they say that?
There would have been other ways to say it.
You owe us this money, and by the way, you can't use your card until you pay us and we reinstate you or something like that. Isn't that the...
Well, at this point, it's been they can't use the card at all. They didn't...
Well, why don't they say you can't use the card? You owe us this money. You can't use your card anymore.
I agree they could have said that. There's no doubt.
A lot clearer.
It's another way of saying, I think
the agreement is revoked, what interest rate do they charge? And under what terms do they do the collection if that agreement's revoked?
They're going to continue to collect it pursuant to the rate that was in force at the time. Usually,
how do they do that without the agreement?
If they don't have the agreement, they would apply the state rate, and that came up in the Alvira case here. They'll apply the default rate under state law typically.
But in the notices you were sending, you used the card rate, the agreement rate, didn't you?
It was just a balance in full. It was reflected on the last bill, as I recall it. In one instance, it was $3,000. I don't recall the exact number in the other bill.
I was asking about the interest rate.
I do not know what interest rate they applied. The letter didn't discuss the interest rate. It just asked for the balance in full, the full amount that was unpaid after the use of the card for a period of time. They had used the card, got bills, weren't paying it.
Well, isn't interest accruing, though? They send you the letter. It's dated, whatever it's dated. They're just asking for the balance. Now, what if they don't pay? What happens next?
Well, as I say, they're going to continue to try to collect the amount that's owed, the balance in full. So that the.
But is interest running as they do that?
I can tell you, typically they will accrue interest. And it's either going to be done in one of three ways. Either they're not going to accrue interest, they're going to accrue interest under a state default rate. If there's any question or any ambiguity, that's what the industry does. And so they'll apply in Illinois either 5 or 9%. Other states, I think it's Indiana, it's 21%. Or if they have the exact default rate under the agreement, they're going to continue to apply that if they choose to.
And so typically, wouldn't the record have to include that for summary judgment to have been granted here? What rate you were trying to collect on that balance?
There's really no issue ever raised in the complaint. The complaint raised one claim. It was
that it was false.
E claim that the language is false under E, correct?
So you've got to show that it's true.
Well, there's no doubt. They don't even contest that they couldn't use the card any longer. There's not even an issue with that.
Part of it, but that agreement included a lot of other things too.
Correct.
An obligation to pay and a rate. So.
Correct. And we state that in the letter, that you have to pay. The balance in full is now due, as opposed to a credit card. You can make a minimum payment. It's no longer an option. The balance in full is now due. That previous efforts were made. We're going to continue to collect until this balance is due, is paid, excuse me. And they identify that balance that they're seeking to collect now. They're telling them it's revoked. What do people, when you get a credit card, it's an understanding I can take that card, I can get merchandise, and I can pay whatever I'm being asked to pay, a minimum balance usually, or a full amount if you choose. And in this instance, the people here that were subject to this letter were people that had that experience. They went and used the card.
But what's confusing about it is that the agreement hasn't been rescinded. It's still in force. It's the privilege of using the card that's been revoked.
And I think when you get it right. Yes, we're not talking about rescission.
Since it's literally false, because the agreement has not been rescinded, revoked, whatever that means. The agreement is still in force.
Well,
it's the right to use the card that's been revoked.
Right, I think
pursuant to the agreement.
Right.
It's the agreement that grants that authority.
Which gets back, correct. And we point out...
So the agreement is being enforced, not revoked.
The use of the card, the original agreement...
It doesn't say that.
It does not say that. And that's why, do consumers who are getting this, the people who are getting this, the 7,000 people as he identified, understand it the way the judge understood it?
We don't know.
Well, I think it's a reasonable interpretation. We put in the record evidence that revoked is commonly used in the state statutes where it's improper to use a revoked credit card. That's the term that's typically used. It's a violation of law to use a revoked card.
It doesn't say revoked credit card.
It says revoked agreement.
Revoked agreement.
But that's
in the record, we put other agreements that are typical. You can just get on the web and get these from the companies, and they use the term it's revoked. It doesn't mean you don't owe the money. And the letter's clearly saying you owe the money.
But now, do you agree with your opponent that that the plaintiffs can't get any damages without a valid survey?
No, that has nothing to do with it.
Excuse me?
No, a survey has nothing to do with whether they can seek or recover actual damages. 692K identifies the standards that are going to be considered in determining damages statutorily. And
so you're arguing against yourself.
No, I'm saying that they didn't meet... No.
You're saying they don't need a... They have a lousy survey. That's
they have a lousy
sure.
survey.
But you say they don't need a survey.
No. I'm saying they need a survey in order to meet their evidentiary burden of whether there's a violation of the act. They don't need it for damages.
We're not talking about the violation. We're talking about damages. Suppose we said this is confusing on its face.
Right.
Then the only relevance of the survey, as they argue, would be to statutory damages. But you're saying you don't need a survey for statutory damages.
Your cases on surveys do not address whether or not they are necessary for damages under K. All those cases for surveys talk about whether or not the plaintiff has met the burden to establish a violation under E, F, or G. The damages are whatever actual damages the person can show. Typically, they try to either say they paid money they didn't owe, or they had actual damage in the sense of emotional distress under the standards, or they'd seek statutory damages up to $1,000 or 1% of the net worth using the four factors identified in K.
Do they need a survey in order to get statutory damages?
A survey is not related to damages, Your Honor.
Not related?
No.
How do they argue the judge should be $1,000 rather than 2 cents?
692K says they can try to show the nature of the violation, the intent of the defendant, and the frequency and persistence of the violation. Those are the three things in an individual claim that are considered in deciding what to award between 0 and 1,000. And then in a class claim, they throw in the fourth component for statutory damages up to 1% of the net worth, which is the net worth of the defendant. But
the 1% is not in this case. Right?
No. Yes, it was. In this case, it was a class action. It was actually certified as a class. But this, just to be clear, the surveys have to do with their burden. And I'm saying they don't meet their burden because the survey was terrible, as the judge agreed. So in the one instance, he's...
Of course, your opponent said that the survey was relevant only to damages.
I think he made a mistake. I think he misstated that, Judge. It's not.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Schultz. So, Mr. Blythen, have any time? No, but we'll give you a minute to try to straighten out this confusing...
Your Honor, if I said that the survey is necessary for damages or we can't get any...
You say that several times, actually.
Okay, that I misspoke. The survey goes towards the amount of damages, not that it's required for damages.
So now your opponent says you need the survey to show that this is confusing, that there's a violation.
Your Honor, there have been several cases in the Seventh Circuit where the court has held that if the letter is false or contains a false statement, you do not need a survey because something that is false is a violation of the statute.
What if it's confusing? Do you need a survey if it's just if it's confusing?
Not always, Your Honor. If it's confusing on its face, such as Chiu-A versus National Action.
Well, is your argument this is confusing on its face or just confusing as shown by the survey?
Our Our argument is that it's false. The original agreement is certainly in effect.
Why do you have this false and not false? Can't you just say it's confusing? Why does it have to be false?
The statute uses the term false. Well, it uses both terms, but
okay. So what do you need the false? What do you get from false that you don't have with confusing?
I guess it's clearer.
It's not. It's not clearer at all. Because who knows what's... Can't figure out what's false because we don't know what these things mean, right? Revoking an agreement is not actually a legal... That's not a coherent legal concept. You can rescind an agreement. You don't revoke an agreement. You can breach a contract, you can terminate a contract without a breach, you can rescind... You can't revoke an agreement. Revoke is unilateral, right?
Right.
So this is confusing rather than, you know, demonstrably false, right?
Well, I believe it's both.
What difference does it make? Why haggle over whether something is false or merely confusing when the statute forbids both types of representation?
I guess I won't, Your Honor.
Okay.